Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Chris. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. I'm a little better than the last time we saw each other. I finally recovered from my cold. I think I might have COVID.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I just was feeling crummy.
Gosh, that's still sticking around?
No, I'm good now.
I think you gave it to me.
Well, hopefully.
No. Hopefully not.
Oh, we got to get that herd immunity going.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think we got a great lineup for today, so let's hear what you got for me.
So there's this concerning conflict resolution trend on college campuses these days. There are these so-called no contact orders, originally meant to protect victims of sexual harassment, that have become this kind of go-to solution for the Gen Z crowd. So I read the story of a freshman at Clemson where he found himself charged with assault by another student in his dorm.
Actual assault, or just like verbally, like he felt made other people feel
uncomfortable? Well, assault can be verbal, right? Assault is the imminent apprehension of harm.
Okay.
Right? Battery is the actual smackdown.
Mm-hmm.
So before even investigating the situation, the dean issues a no contact order against this kid. It remains in effect even after he was fully exonerated by the subsequent investigation. So the onus was on him to avoid any run-ins with his accuser. He ends up transferring the following year. His mom is justifiably furious over what she views as a student making up an assault claim to handle what was simply a bad fit between roommates.
Mm-hmm.
So this trend is not just on Clemson's campus. From the Seton Hall University handbook, students can seek to have no communication due to, quote, significant conflict. This is designed to prevent escalation.
Mm-hmm.
So this has to reflect some deeper issues going on with our young people with interpersonal
Clearly.
Skill development.
Yes.
So, you know, direct conversation used to be the method.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your thoughts on what's going on here, and I'll give you mine.
Well, I think there's two elements that I would bring out, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Chris, too. And I'm sure all of our listeners have got some their own stories and their points of contact with this. But certainly, I've seen a trend longer term in the United States. This is, you know, even our generation, where people are struggling to dialogue. We get sideways so quickly, and anything that talks about religion or politics, and people seem to just shut down, and they can't have a rational conversation about people, and, you know, trying to think the best of them. So there's a tendency, even among adults, to polarize. It's a characteristic of Americans right now. We tend to be either black or white, and have difficulty in seeing nuance. Second thing I would throw in there is for young people, I think, who are growing up with cell phones, who maybe don't know how to have a conversation with a person, they'll just text people. There's this tendency we have towards polarization has been accentuated even more. Algorithms that we utilize for all of our social media and things tend to exacerbate this problem, because we're just getting the information that is tailored to us, and we're not hearing other points of view. And this is problematic. So those are a couple of things that I would throw in.
I think the cell phone comment is apropos, because I think, like many, that you can text and not worry about the response. When you can say a lot of things on text that if you said to somebody in person, you'd get smacked.
Yeah. Well, then, or on social media posts, or, you know, on a comment page, people say the really horrendous and mean things that they would never say to a person in real life, because you've got to deal with the emotions and you've got to deal with the possibility of getting smacked.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think it's another tactic of the evil one to just sow division
and separate us.
Yeah. I mean, that's his job, right? He's constantly trying to create factions.
He does that. And God always brings unity and openness and dialogue and love, which entails patience and actually dealing with real people and their emotions.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
I want to talk about AI and chatbots.
Ooh, that sounds exciting.
So the Pygmalion myth in Greek mythology is the story of the sculptor who falls in love with the statue he creates. The sculptor was disillusioned with women, so he creates this perfect figure from ivory, prays to the goddess Aphrodite to bring the statue to life, and the statue comes to life.
That sounds a lot like what's going on in Japan right now.
Right. So
we're creating these avatars of perfect girlfriends.
Yeah. Right. So the lesson of this Greek mythology story is that Pygmalion simply allows himself to fall in love with his own, with an externalization of his own ingenuity.
Okay.
So, first question to consider. Is this a process that mirrors the biblical accounts of the making of false idols? And so when we make an item that ends up being so impressive to us that we worship it and thereby become its servant.
Mm-hmm. Well, very simply put, yes. I think that, but I would expand, I mean, we have a capacity to make anything into an idol. Anything that we put before God, I mean, it can be something as silly as a pen. You know, this is a funny example because, you know, as a religious, I have a vow of poverty and I don't own anything. The only thing I own is a crucifix. And when we're in the novitiate, I got this really cool pen from my mom and dad and I got attached to the pen. And I realized that after a certain time that I was putting more emphasis on this silly pen than I was on loving God, and it was distracting me. And the same thing can happen with all of us. Anything we put before God becomes a form of idolatry. It's an idol.
Well, some of what we're going to cover in this segment has helped me have a better understanding. You know, in reading the Old Testament stories, like the second that Moses leaves, every time they create a right. golden calf or right. something to create an idol.
Yeah.
So I never understood that. It just didn't make any sense to me until I was reading these recent articles about AI.
Yeah. And sometimes we think like we have some sort of moral superiority, like, oh, we're so much better than the Israelites, where they were so stupid, they kept falling away from God. We do the same thing, Chris, all right. the time. I do too, and I'm a priest.
Yeah.
And I think we have to safeguard against that tendency that we have to put things before God in our lives.
Yeah, so the next part of this, I think, is the more nuanced part. Mm-hmm. So it's the demons in ChatGPT. So St. Augustine's perspective on demonic deception through signs reflects his thoughts about the spiritual dangers of misdirected curiosity.
Yes.
So in City of God and On Christian Doctrine, he argues that demons as fallen angels retain intelligence, but use it to lead humans astray through false wonders and misleading phenomena.
Right.
So Augustine saw human curiosity as fundamentally good when directed towards God, but dangerous when it was just vain curiosity.
Well, I'm going to add another element in there that I think comes from many theologians and those who work with this reality of the occult and demonic, is that when we want to control things, that's when the devil really comes into play. You see this when people get involved in the occult. A lot of times it's because they want to control a relationship. They want to control an outcome of health. They want to know the future. So that's oftentimes the hook that the devil uses to get us caught into these things. It's our desire to control things.
Right. So he believes that demons exploit our weakness that you're referring to, about control, by offering these impressive but hollow signs that satisfy our desire for the extraordinary while pulling us away from the genuine truth. So in regards to modern AI systems like ChatGPT, so some philosophers are drawing parallels to Augustine's warnings about deceptive knowledge sources. They might argue that while AI can provide impressive displays of information processing, there's a risk of mistaking sophisticated text generation for genuine wisdom. So in keeping with this, the New York Times reports on a strange phenomenon of ChatGPT users believing that generative AI models are giving them access to intelligent entities, and they're convinced that these chatbot windows are windows into other realms.
I think that's pretty weird. And I wouldn't exclude the possibility that, you know, there could be a demonic influence in a chat bot or in one of these things. But in general, they're large language models. They're built on, artificial intelligence, which is using all this information to tell us different things and to summarize things. I use it pretty frequently now. It's been a really helpful tool for, you know, making a business plan or saying what are some insights on how to overcome this temptation. There's some really good insights that come from AI because it's pulling from a lot of really good resources. You know, but as in all things in this world, the devil can stick himself in there and try to use it to take us away from God. So I think we have to be cautious, as with any new technology, but at the same time, not be overly like a stick in the mud. Like, I'm not going to use any new technology.
Just yeah, and I'm not saying
be a danger there.
Right, I'm not saying that's the case. What I am getting at is that I never understood, like I said, this desire to all of a sudden make a false idol, or I never really understood, you know, many of our Indian, Native American Indian cultural items are these things that are in the animal kingdom, mm-hmm. right? You might see some intricate, you know, woven rug that has flocks of birds, or mm-hmm. oftentimes are just symbols of things with their names oftentimes are related to the animal kingdom, right? These, they're Indian, they're quote Indian name. I don't know mm-hmm. what you call these. So what I took from this article I read was, or this article had a reflection on this facet, was that in On Christian Doctrine, Augustine describes how ancient diviners had they saw these patterns in animal entrails or the flight of birds. The signs mm-hmm. themselves mean nothing, but the observer predisposed to look for things mistakes the coincidence for revelation.
Mm-hmm.
So demons observing this error encourage it. The signs mean nothing, but we choose to treat them as meaningful because of what we already want to see.
So basically seeing patterns when there really aren't any.
Right.
Or trying to, yeah, I mean, that's part of many ancient cultures and even some modern cultures that are not
Christian.
That's
what's happening with some folks thinking they're seeing a different, you know, world that's,
right.
that AI is exposing them.
Or imagining that they're getting messages from angels, which could be demons misleading them. Yeah, the spiritual world, Chris, is rife with opportunities for distraction and for being deceived. And I think that's where we need to always go back to Christ. Christ at the center. Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. There is no angel, there's no animal, there's no diviner that can say that they are the way, the truth, and the life. And Christ gives us that security. And oftentimes what people are looking for in the ability to control their future or control their environment or control their relationships, they're seeking a power that is outside of Christ. And
yeah,
Christ
so is this
gives
what,
us that
power. Is this what the Jews were doing when they created the golden calf or some other?
Most certainly it was, because they were looking for a way to connect with the culture of their local area. There was there's some cults that were connected to the divinity of the sacred cows. And so they were creating a confidence booster for themselves, a sense of being able to control their reality. That's where they're always going back to. And this is the same thing that happens to us in our life today. When we try to control things and we feel like we're not getting that through our Catholic faith, people start looking for other things.
And I get getting attached to material things. What I've never gotten is the need to all of a sudden, like if you're talking about your pen, if you made a golden pen and then started, you know, worshiping your pen,
well,
I don't get it.
Yeah, that's a silly example.
But this is maybe a little, you know, insight into what happens when that, mm-hmm. you know, in the Old Testament stories.
I think you're right.
So the third facet of this was that there's this risk of AI sycophancy when you consider that a Chat GPT interface effectively becomes this hall of mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
So a model fed by our prompts that then presents back to us our own ideas as brilliant, which is what I think, by the way, business consultants do.
And it always starts that way, actually, when you get the... I use Gemini, Google Gemini for my AI. And whenever I put a prompt in, it says, oh, that's such a wonderful idea. So insightful. And that could give many... there is a certain amount of sycophancy that's going on with AI because it's building off your prompts. And then if you challenge it always says, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to leave that out. So you do have to check it, and it can try to build upon your ego. So you're making a good point there.
Yeah, the model predicts what we expect.
To a certain degree.
Right, so we supply the attention and the interpretation, and then the, quote, spirit that we sense is a reflection of our own appetites fed back to us in the form of this reply.
I think to a certain extent, but it's also amplifying and going beyond what we can think of. So you can put in a general prompt and it'll come up with creative stuff that I never thought of. I didn't
sure.
think of putting
yeah,
it
I'm
in.
Not saying that it's bad. I'm saying that there is this fault that is possible. That
certainly is. And I think that's why we always have to use AI or any other technology with certain critical error to make sure that we're using it well and that we're not completely relying upon it.
The last part of the AI that I wanted to talk about is this the learning implications of using these large language mm-hmm. models. There's a study that finds that people who use AI to research topics have this weaker understanding of the
clearly
of the topic, right? And so I find this akin to children who learn. I didn't know this until recently, actually talking to a retired teacher friend, that when you are learning taking notes using cursive, you retain better the information and have a better understanding and grasp than if you write it in print.
Interesting.
And, you know, I always knew that if you print, you know, notes, like I always took notes in print. I didn't realize I was supposed to be doing it in cursive. But I got this sense that I was, you know, retaining things better by writing it down versus typing it into
definitely
a laptop, mm-hmm. right? So, and that's already been proven.
Well, I had a friend who actually would take notes, who would take copious notes during a presentation of a professor or a visiting professor. And at the end of the of taking those notes, he would just throw them away. I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, this is how I learn. If I don't take notes, I'm receiving it too passively. I'm not engaging with the subject matter. But when I take notes, then I've digested it. I've interiorized it." I think it's very much related to what we're talking about here with AI, because I was talking with my niece, who's 11 years old, just recently, and she said, "Oh, I was, you know, doing this online schooling thing, and I would just put it into ChatGPT, and I would get the answers, and I didn't really learn anything." I said, "Of course you didn't learn anything, because learning entails engaging with the subject matter. It means wrestling with it, understanding it, dissecting it, putting it back together. And when you're letting a machine do that, you're not actually learning the material. You can maybe regurgitate it or put it into a paper, but the intellectual process of engaging with the subject matter and thinking and pulling it apart and putting it back together, that's how we learn as humans."
And studies show that handwriting engages more sensory skills and memory centers than typing it into a laptop. And so I think this is akin to learning something using these large language models and not actually ever grasping. You're sort of just, you're getting the answer. It's like a calculator. You're getting the answer.
Yes.
You're not learning the mechanics
it's
of how to get the answer.
It's the illusion of learning. You think that you're learning something because you can regurgitate it, but you actually haven't learned it. So I think that there's definitely something that teachers and educators right now are really wrestling with this issue, because it's affecting all of our educational system. And teachers have to change the way that they're teaching in order to help students to actually learn.
Well, my wife mentioned to me recently that she has never seen me write anything cursive. So I apparently am missing out on quite a bit of what I think I know, because I write
well,
it down.
Good opportunity for personal growth there, Chris.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
We talked in a previous episode about the dignity of the human body, even in death.
Yeah, of course.
A story came out recently in DeKalb County about community members holding this ceremony at a park in DeKalb County called Legacy Park.
Okay.
Where they were honoring 33 individuals, mostly children, whose unmarked graves were discovered at the former Methodist Children's Home site.
Mm.
The graves go back to the early 1800s. I've been listening from time to time in the Bible in a Year podcast, and I remember from some of the readings about Numbers or several passages about ritual impurity about related to coming in contact with the dead.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Including even walking over graves.
Mm.
So the Book of Numbers suggests that that this renders you ceremonially unclean.
Mm-hmm.
So inadvertent contact with the dead, like people have, it's a park. People have been walking over these unmarked graves. I think the Catholic view on this is more, it's a bad etiquette. You correct me if I'm wrong here, that we have gone from it being, making you ceremonially unclean to being more respectful. It's disrespectful. But if you're doing something like that inadvertently, any issue?
I think if it's inadvertent, there's no conscious, there's nothing morally wrong with it. In order for something to be moral, it has to be free. And if I'm not aware of something, my intellect is not involved, it can't be free. So if someone is just, they're walking along and they happen to walk over a grave, this happened to me 2 years ago. I was up hiking in North Georgia and I was hiking through backcountry and all of a sudden I walked across a graveyard. And it was really fascinating because there were some graves from, you know, guys from the Civil War era. I walked up across the corner of the graveyard, didn't realize it. And then like, oh my gosh, there's a bunch of graves here. So I stopped and then I prayed, you know, prayed a rosary for the repose of the souls that were there. And I think that's the key thing is once we become aware of the reality that there's human beings that are buried in an area, we want to show respect.
Right, but why the Old Testament, even if it was inadvertent, if you walked over a grave, why were you then, even inadvertently?
Ritually unclean?
Right.
I don't recall that. You'd have to show me the specific passage. I know that if you touched a body, mm-hmm. you were ritually unclean. But I don't know about walking over the grave inadvertently. But I think certainly for us as Catholics, there's a better understanding of the nature of morality. Morality comes into play only when we are conscious and free. If, for example, in the Catechism, the Catholic Church talks about, you know, if I have a spontaneous reaction of anger to a situation, well, anger is neither good nor bad as a passion. It's what I do with it. When I become aware of it and then act upon it freely, that's when it becomes moral. Otherwise, it's morally neutral.
Right. So would you characterize it as etiquette or is it something more?
I think it's something more than etiquette. Etiquette always reflects values that we have. And so in the case of, walking in a cemetery or a graveyard, there's an etiquette which reflects a deeper value, which is we value the body of those who have died because it was, now it's turned to dust or there's bones left, but that was a temple of the Holy Spirit, body and soul. The soul was united to the body at death, separated. And so we value that body, which was a temple of the Holy Spirit. That's why we do burial of the body primarily as Catholics.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
And the last topic for today, we have the possible eminent domain of Pope Leo's home in Chicago, his childhood home.
Interesting.
Eminent domain has traditionally been used for infrastructure projects. Mm-hmm. You know,
when you need to build a road, you got to, you know, government
water
takes
supply.
Control of something. Yep.
Right. Or, you know, it could be for aid in national defense.
Sure.
They also recognize that historical sites help maintain the identity of a community, and so preserving the cultural heritage might justify eminent domain. So for this one, this home is located in a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it would be that it's for tourism that would justify the public interest in it.
Sure.
What I think is interesting about this is the, you know, oft heard and you and I discuss frequently the separation of church and state. So, mm-hmm. so embracing Christianity when it serves the state's needs.
It's interesting how that plays out, isn't it?
So the, you know that I do prison ministry.
Right.
I have found the same thing where you're not allowed to, in a public school, have anything that would, you know, be close to like a Christmas party or celebration of Easter.
Or prayer before a game. Or
right.
Sure.
Yet in the prison that I go to, they have a faith-based unit where, you know, it's not just Christianity, but all faiths are encouraged, and they know that the faith-based unit has better outcomes and
right.
actions within the prison. It's another interesting paradox with the government, again, using Christianity when it's convenient and when it's
It's kind of a strange schizophrenia that we have in our country right now, because from a practical standpoint, and actually one of the books that I've written is called Better with God, and it goes into all the sociological facts that show that people who practice Christianity are way better off than people who don't. And we see that in the prison system, as you've seen. We see it in rehab. People who are going through drug treatment or coming out of sexual addiction or things like that, people who engage with faith and with God, they do much better off.
Yeah, can't we just admit that when society embraces Judeo-Christian morals and ethics, that's
so much better off. Yeah, but it's this strange dichotomy that we, an invention of separation of church and state, which didn't actually exist in the Constitution or in the Bill of Rights. So I think we need to go back to a recognition that there is a value of the church and the state. There needs to be a proper separation, like Jesus himself advocates for that. He says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. But there's a very beautiful role that faith can play in informing public opinion and bringing us back always to the truth and not being afraid to challenge political power.
In this case, though, you have a house in a neighborhood.
Yep.
That purely for tourism purposes, I can't see where the government has this right to come in. Let's say the sellers were reluctant. The people, let's say the owners were reluctant to be sellers. It's not the right case, not what's happening here, but let's say they were. I can't see that this is a proper use of eminent domain. If I would see the more traditional way of, say, a group of Catholic, donate the money to buy the home and then,
put it in a trust.
Put it in trust and then give it to the state for them to use it. Whereas if you had people living in this house and they wanted to eminent domain this house, I would say that's wrong.
Hmm. I don't know. I might take a little bit different tack on that one, Chris, because I think there is an interest for the state and a prominent citizen who's from the area, first American Pope. We want to celebrate that. This is important for the Chicago area. I could see a case for the state taking an interest in that.
I think it should be done privately.
I love that we have a little disagreement every once in a while.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.